and it's 9 o'clock, and you're tuned to WOWDLP Tacoma Park.
What made it him ya patani? Dan Shabayane Yinne Idan. Tora Pidin Fil Athani. Alna Tatani. Kulgum kulgum gider avlum, akşidir şeyimin ney bağlı. Göktür çeşmeli tuğdum, yağlamanın korkarı. Yağlar yandım.
Good morning, everyone. We hope you're having a great start to your day. We hope you can get you juiced to talking about art, and this is the Artist Experience radio program from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. every other Saturday. We want to thank our listeners for contributing to the WOWD Tacoma Park fun drive, the March 4th fun drive. We appreciate all your donations and your support of the station. We hope you've enjoyed Meg early this morning with her eclectic musical selection. She's amazing, but also, wow, Robin's Radio. This is a great show for kids and adults alike. And this is one of our new exciting programs that come right before us in the morning on Saturdays. This is Tom Xenakis, and I'm with Sheila Blake, and we're the hosts of the Ars Experience radio show.
Hi, the Artist Experience is an hour-long radio show. It's dedicated to looking at art, and we hope that Tom and I can introduce our listeners to what we've been looking at and help you when you visit the exhibit, create in your soul, in your experience, your own work of art. We have an Artist Experience page on Facebook where we also put images of the things we're talking about. It's a place we'd love our listeners to give us ideas and feedback. Please look at it if you can while you're listening. You can stream this program on tacomaradio.org, and also we're putting podcasts of this show on my website, sheilablake.com, and on artasexperience.com, so you can listen at any time, and the podcast can be also be found on iTunes.
You know, in our last show, we took you to one of the great museums of D.C., the Phillips Collection. Sheila and I wanted to introduce to another local museum, which I think is one of the best-kept secrets in town, and that's the new location on the grounds of George Washington University, and this is the Textile Museum of the George Washington University System. This is a museum treasure that has been around for a long time. Its former location was near DuPont Circle, a few houses away from the Woodrow Wilson House in the George Hewitt Myers House, but it now finds a great state-of-the-art facility in Foggy Bottom. We're excited to introduce the Textile Museum today on our show with an incredible exhibition titled Binding the Clouds, The Art of Central Asian Ikat. The exhibition goes on through July 9th. There's an $8 suggested donation to the museum, and there are other exhibitions concurrently going on there, but we invite you to study this great exhibition and see the other exhibitions at the same time in a very beautiful and intimate, stress-free museum viewing art experience that could be done in a few hours. I wanted to mention we introduced the show with a song titled Turkmen, which the Turkmen are the nomadic tribes which came from Central Asia, and this was a contemporary Persian classical version of the song Turkmen, because we'll be talking about that interesting place that this exhibit talks about, and that's Central Asia.
So the new Textile Museum is located at the corner of 21st Street and G Street in the Foggy Bottom neighborhood of D.C., and it's accessible at the Foggy Bottom GWU Metro stop on the blue, orange, and silver lines. Although parking can be tough there's a metered parking zone in the area, so you have to pay for street parking. Early arrivals to the museum on the weekends seem to be good for parking, from Tom's experience.
That's right.
And the museum has a fantastic library and gift shop. Oh, boy. So you can look at museum.gwu.edu. It's a real treat. It's one of Washington's best kept secrets, and it's an incredible museum.
You know, I love the Textile Museum. I was involved there for about 10 years, but I had to pull away from my involvement, and I went off to do other things. But this is a really fantastic and professional outfit from the administrators, the curators, the educational staff, the library people, those people involved in all levels. It really is a classy place, and I've known these people since 1996. And the levels of professionalism and passion for their museum work with textiles is world-class, and I really mean world-class. And the new facilities are amazing. It houses one of the largest collections of textiles on the globe. And it's not just about old textiles. It's about new, contemporary people working with textile arts, with world-class exhibitions, and historical exhibitions about the textile arts from Washington, the U.S., and the globe. And there's also a gallery at the museum that highlights Washington history.
Well, this whole visit was Tom's great idea. It's a great idea.
Okay.
In our explorations, there were many new things to look at and so many things that I didn't know anything about. And so this, I feel as though I can learn everything about history, about geography, through this one subject of textiles. Because like learning about pigments and learning about textiles is another lens to learn about the world. Textiles have been a part of civilization, clothing, shelter, decoration, weaving dates back to the Neolithic cultures of about 5,000 BCE. So specimens of dyed fabrics were found in Roman ruins. The museum is a lovely place. It's airy and friendly on the GW campus. And can I mention the gift shop again?
Go right ahead, Sheila.
Well, they have really beautiful and unusual things. They have jewelry, fabrics, cards.
You should go for your wallet, because it's worth it.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful gift shop. It really is. The exhibition we're going to talk about ties into a few programs that Sheila did in the summer on color and the origins and history of colors. In the textile world, there's an expression that goes like this: color, color, color. The love of textiles has a lot to do with colors and color qualities and color interactions. Additionally, these textiles address textures, patterns, shapes, and forms, but color really rules, especially in this exhibition. In this exhibition of Binding the Clouds, The Art of Central Asian Ikat is a visual feast of sumptuous color, intense color, that seems really modern. Sheila, you love color. What about introducing us to color as we experienced it in the Textile Museum in this exhibition?
Well, First of all, I want to say that this exhibition highlights 35 ikat hangings from 76 pieces, which were donated to the Textile Museum by Dr. Guido Goldman in 2015. It was in honor of Bruce Baggins, who was the president of the Textile Museum and the Board of Trustees and co-chair of the GW Museum Board of Trustees. So Mr. Goldman's generous gift now makes the Textile Museum collection one of the largest Central Asian ikat collections in the U.S. Dr. Guido Goldman came to the United States post-World War II as a young German-Jewish immigrant. As a lover of the arts, he began collecting these ikats in the mid-1970s, only a few years after he came to the U.S. He appreciated the bold colors and designs that were modern and abstract, much like the paintings of Kandinsky. Dr. Goldman has an incredible eye for beauty. And these hangings, they're a virtual bombardment of color. They knock your socks off color. In color theory, you learn that there are seven color contrasts. Contrast of hue, contrast of light, cold-warm contrast, complementary contrast, simultaneous contrast, saturation, and extension. These hangings use contrast of hue. Hue is like what you would say are the names of the colors, red, green, yellow. And they bombard you with the brightest, most colorful color. And complementary contrast is bouncing off colors that are the opposite on the color wheel. So like reds bounce off greens, yellows bounce off blues or purples. And in the case of natural dyes, the purples are called aubergine. So by separating the colors with white, which can happen naturally in the weaving process, the colors don't influence each other. So each color has maximum power.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And, you know, it's interesting that Dr. Goldman cites Kandinsky, who we agree is a great modern painter. But coincidentally, Kandinsky in his own life was interested in the art and the spirituality of shamanistic cultures within the Russian sphere, and which would be interesting because that would be the Central Asian, you know, tribal groups. And he was very familiar with ikats, I'm sure. You know, I teach color theory right now, and it amazes me how these artisans and planners of these textiles really have a great understanding of color theory and color interactions and color blending to give the maximal visual punch. It amazes me that artists and designers of these textiles did not have to go to university to understand color interaction and mixing. And that's kind of where I laugh. You know, students are paying all that money and these guys just know it from the top of their heads. There is a great level of visual sophistication. And some of this happens in just studying the colors around in nature, the things right before your eyes. I think that's really important. You've got to look out there in the forest and the mountains and see how colors work together. And I think this is what these people are doing. What is that combination? The experimentation and the process of mixing color dyes, which historically were from nature, dyes from vegetable and animal and insects like skins and husks from vegetable matter, indigo and matter, turmeric, cochineal. Well, there are many colors from natural sources, and I heard speaking to someone at the textile that every one of those textiles that we see were natural dyes.
Uh-huh.
That was in question because chemical dyes invaded the dyer's palette at the end of the 18th century, but I not next 19th century. I apologize by that, but I am not certain how that affected the commercial ventures of ikat. So after the Soviet Union came down into Central Asia and took over those basically countries and territories, I would tend to think that there were more easily available and less expensive chemical dyes that also made the ikat. And I think probably contemporary ikat is very much chemical dyes. But the great news again is that dyes used in these textiles at the Textile Museum are natural dyes, and that's amazing. So, Sheila, why don't you take us down the Silk Road where all this all began?
Yeah, well, I wanted to add something to what you said, is that the colors from natural dyes harmonize in a way that chemical dyes just can't. And one of the things that I love about these dyes are the yellows, because the yellows are so, they're subtle and sumptuous. and they're soft yellows. They don't have, you know, when you think of yellow, you think, okay, you know, it's going to push through everything.
Garish, yeah. Garish, yeah. You think of a garish yellow.
Oh, my
yeah.
God. The reds, too. It's beautiful color. So the Silk Road derives its name from the lucrative trade in silk, which was carried out along its length beginning in the Han Dynasty, which was 207 BCE to 220 CE. The Han Dynasty expanded the Central Asian section of the trade routes around 114 BCE through the missions and explorations of the Chinese imperial envoy Zhang Khan. The Chinese took great interest in the safety of their trade products and extended the Great Wall of China to ensure the protection of the trade route, which is something I did not know.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense, right? I didn't know that either.
Ah, so trade on the Silk Road played a significant role in the development of the civilizations of China, Korea, Japan, the Indian subcontinent, Iran, Persia, Europe, and the Horn of Africa and Arabia, opening long-distance political and economic relations between the civilizations. Though silk was the major trade item exported from China, many other goods were traded, as well as religions, syncretic philosophies, technologies, and diseases, and most notably plague also spread along the Silk Road. In addition to economic trade, the Silk Road was a route for cultural trade among the civilizations along its network. Traders in antiquity included the Bactrians, Sogdians, Syrians, Jews, Arabs, Iranians, Turkmens, Chinese, Indians, Somalis, Greeks, Romans, Georgians, and Armenians. In June 2014, UNESCO designated the Chang'an-Tishan corridor of the Silk Road as a World Heritage Site. The Indian portion is on the tentative site list.
Wow. Well, this history of these textiles is really long in time and certainly in miles. And we're talking about arts and crafts that originated mostly on the Silk Road. So these ikats are coming right from there. And, you know, the fact that it came from China and Mongolia originally, the Silk Road was historically a route that came from East Asia west. So we have a lot of these countries today, just to put in contemporary perspective, like the Stans, they're called, Tajikistan, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, Afghanistan. And then we have these Iran, Iraq, Turkey, Azerbaijan, the Caucasus, Anatolia, and you know, even into eventually Europe. So we have a lot of different countries that with a lot of different ethnic peoples and religions along the Silk Road. And the golden period of Central Asia within these empires and regions was when the ruler Tamerlane or Amir Timur came to power. He lived in 1336 to the 1405. Although in the West he is known as a Turco-Mongol conqueror in the West, he is a descendant of Genghis Khan. His rule brought about a lot of flourishing in Islamic culture, and I think we don't get that in the West so much. They don't talk about the positive things in education, arts, and trades. And he melded his conquests to the Mamluk Egyptian dynasties, the Syrian, Arab, Ottoman, Indian, Persian. And so he took all these nomadic armies, and he encompassed a huge landmass, bringing education and arts, and he was a big promoter of the arts, Tamerlane. The Silk Road landed and had land and sea routes, and I think that's really important that we forget about the sea route of the Silk Road. And there was things like silk, spices, narcotics is something that, you know, a lot of times we don't mention, dyes, foods, metals, and minerals, and textiles were brought to the West. The Silk Road brought humans in of various ethnicities, philosophies, and religions, and animals of various exotic types were also brought to the West with diseases as well, as Sheila mentioned. The expansion of trade was notable in the textiles, especially with silk and other fabric weaving. Velvets and ikats are just two examples, and wow, in this exhibition, they're absolutely beautiful. This explosion of commerce and cross-cultural pollinization reached the Ottoman Empire that had already been trading with Europe at the time. I think a lot of people forget that the Italians were trading with the Ottoman Empire, which which is the basically one of the last stops on the Silk Route. So the concept of Italian velvet comes through. You know, that's where the Italians got their velvet from. They learned it from the Ottomans and further east. Well, the textiles arts, the decorative arts, the fine arts, it was like a tsunami of arts just created a new whole visual vocabulary in the arts of Europe. Oriental carpets, fabrics, velvet manufacture and dyeing techniques came from all these Silk Road spots. And so we're going to kind of continue on this because it's really important that how this visual vocabulary came into the West. And Sheila, you have a little ditty on that one.
Yeah. Well, you know, whenever I start something new, I need a kind of touchstone. So I thought, what is my touchstone with Ecott Textiles? So I knew about the Gobelin tapestries. The Gobelins were a family of dyers who established themselves in the middle of the 15th century in France. And the Gobelin tapestries were traditional subjects woven with amazing richness and skill into wall hangings. And Michel Chevreuil, who was a chemist, he worked as the director of the Gobelin tapestries. And he discovered that the effects of the colors that the threads of the colored threads had on each other. And from that, he developed this theory of simultaneous contrast, which is so important in the Impressionists.
Right. And actually, it's come to modern day. I mean, how textiles are woven. This
yes.
guy revolutionized the
yes.
whole thing for
mm-hmm.
contemporary weaving. I mean, that guy was mm-hmm. a real hero in the textile
mm-hmm.
arts.
And then Henri Matisse grew up in a textile weaving community in Bohain, France, and he was surrounded constantly by beautiful, bold, unique fabrics that were woven by his family. And so not only did he incorporate these fabrics into his paintings, but he also developed his own bold and unique style through the inspiration of the bold nature of these fabrics. Textiles are the common thread that weaves Matisse's style. Inspiration and subject matter, they were all came together to form the tapestry of Matisse's work. So like Paul Klee, when Matisse went to Morocco, color and pattern exploded for him. And if you look at Matisse's patterns, you can see that they were very often like the Ecott patterns of North Africa. And now I can't, you know, there was a show once that I saw that had some of the original textiles that Matisse used, as well as, but at that time I wasn't aware of the differences in
right.
the different kinds of textile making. So, but I can only say that when you look at pictures of Matisse in his studio, you see some of those Ecott patterns. And even they're everywhere. Even I bought paper napkins in IKEA yesterday, and they have the Ecott pattern, and then, you know, the patterns of Pottery Barn. So is that Ecott the name for the yarns, the technique, or the fabric? What, yes to all three. What
yeah.
is the Ecott, Tom?
Well, you know, where Ecott began and when is kind of a big mystery, but it's known that the Dutch traders brought it from Southeast Asia and to the West first by Dutch traders. But in Central Asia, there was a host of cities in the Islamic historical period that was very important on the Silk Road, like Samarkand, Bukhara, and Tashkent. And these were very vibrant places. And the Ecott textiles in this exhibition come from there. These cities are in current day Uzbekistan, and they were freed from the grips of the Soviet Union probably more than 30 years ago now. And this is where our Ecott story begins. Well, just get the word out. We've been talking about Ecott. Let's define it. Ecott is an Indonesian or Malay word that comes into the English language. It means bound or tied. Is a very general term for a host of techniques under this big umbrella of Ecott. In the Central Asian Ecotts, the technique is called Abrabandi, which translates as binding the clouds, such the name of the exhibition. This encompasses the entire class of Uzbek binding, dye resist, and tie-dye techniques. The artist binds sections of silk yarn, and metaphorically it looks like they're actually tying or capturing clouds, because silk could look like clouds mm-hmm. in its color, and silk's just one amazing fabric. I mean, material. The technique in binding the yarns and dyeing them in sequence, which is a very complicated affair. To get a pattern of variety of colors using a host of dye beds and colors, it's a very sequential, complicated, and laborious process. This laborious process probably started on a small family ventures, but that changed, and Ecott production sprang into a more commercial and manufactured way as these Central Asian cities became very vibrant and there was a big market for the Ecott. And again, those cities are really important on our map today, Samarkand, Tashkent, and Bukhara. The fragility of the silk is a limiting factor in this legacy because they don't last long. Silk degrades pretty quickly, so we don't really have a lot of examples of very, very old Ecott. So this silk, Sheila, what about that fragility?
Yeah, well, you know, just natural weather conditions, humidity, heat, wear and tear. Ancient Ecotts couldn't be preserved. And so there are only small, brittle fragments that remain. And they are from the Buddhist cave temples in Western India, South America, Southern Russia, Bali, and Indonesia and Japan. The fabrics are made of silk, cotton, wool, rami, which is a fiber from the nettle plant, and a lot of things now are made with rami, and banana fiber. So Ecott is everywhere these days. It's as trendy as anything ancient can ever claim to be. This type of pattern is visible in traditional textiles ranging from Southeast Asia to South America to the Middle East and beyond. And now it lends interiors a kind of dressed up bohemian vibe.
Yeah, that's right. You got it.
And I really want for you all to take in the far reaching across our globe that these industries took place. So when figurative representation was prohibited by Islamic law, design became purely decorative, and the ceremonial requirement of Ecott fabric was no longer relevant. So commercial enterprise became the sole reason for its existence. Fashion played an important part, and designs were changed each year according to demand. Men and women wore different designs. The men's designs were less decorative than those that the women wore. The designs were generally inspired by nature and included twigs, bushes, the tree of life, ram's horns, almonds, pomegranates, seeds, scorpions, bouquets of flowers, plates, lamps, combs, drums, cypress trees, and stylized bird motifs. There's a lot of stuff in there. It's fun to kind of say, oh, is this a seed pod or is this a bird?
Right, name that
object. Yes, name that object. In addition, there were geometric forms, broken lines, chevrons, spirals, rosettes, and dovetailing and arrowheads. The patterns were altered and repeated with variation over time. And now in the modern workshops, new patterns are being created.
Yeah, and these patterns, I mean, the way they put the color combinations together is just amazing. You know, the richness of the organic ties is also astounding. So I know we talked about it in the beginning. So
yeah.
why don't we kind of, because it's really important that these are organic, natural products.
Well, the original dyes are natural dyes, and which means they came from, the indigo is a plant, and madder, which is a root, and that's the red dye. Cochineal is also a red dye. And the yellow is safflower, larkspur, vine leaves, Sephora aponica, delphinium. Greenish yellow from mulberry trees, fungus, indigo vine, and leaves. The orange comes from turmeric, henna, and madder. And then there's a brown madder, walnut or oak bark, and the black gallnut of the pistachio tree. All of these colors came from natural things. The original dyes were often mixed with metals, with copper or iron, to achieve seven colors. And the warp was immersed in as many as three different dye baths. So when you're talking about weaving, you're getting a variety, a tremendous variety out of these seven colors.
No doubt about it. And it's interesting. One of the things that when I was at the exhibition, I was just kind of really thinking about the Russian and Soviet influence that they've imposed on these this fantastic commercial venture that the Uzbeks had, and with ECOT, and you know the Soviets had that controlled state programs, and I just one of the big questions I left with the exhibition is what about how did that benefit the Soviet economy? Were they taking advantage of it? This is kind of a political, kind of economic question I'm asking here. As you go through this entire exhibit with these beautiful dyes, beautiful things, you wonder at what was going on here, because after the Russian Revolution, there was a lot of cotton manufacturing. One of the things, when you look closely at these textiles, they're backed with this Russian printed cotton. And yes. I wonder, like, you know, whose hand in was that? And that's also probably to protect the silk, because the silk is so fragile. I mean, it tears, it decays. And in some ways, that Russian cotton printed cloth probably helps to kind of in some ways preserve them. Mm-hmm. And you know, I have a couple of ECOTs, and even the back, they're holes. I mean, it's such a fragile thing. So it was it's kind of a heavier cotton, and it probably works in some kind of stabilizing the silk hangings and the silk and cotton hangings. And these Russian cloths that are printed on the back of these ECOTs, they didn't show them in the exhibition, which they're pretty amazing itself. So I just wanted to say they're usually floral and very decorative. They're somewhat dated looking, but they're actually very beautiful. One of the things about the exhibition, which is not evident, and I think it was a little disappointing for me, is that there was no worn garments in the exhibition.
That's
there
true.
Were only hanging garments, which, you know, they're all beautiful. There's no doubt about it. But there's something called a chepan or a kapan or a chapkan, which is an outer coat that the Uzbeks used to wear, the men and the women, as you mm-hmm. mentioned before. And there was these kind of pantaloon or pant-like garments that were also lovely in the ECOT, and they were also dyed with the Russian printed cotton cloth. So unfortunately, you know, these functional garments, which they did a lot of, are not in the exhibition, but you'll be wowed by the color anyway, so it doesn't really matter.
Yeah. Well, there's a really good video in the exhibition, and it explains the process of creating ECOT and also the dyeing process. The video was really helpful to me, because it's complicated to explain and it's really worth watching. We almost had to see it twice because the weaving is so complicated. It's so much better to see the process than to describe it as we're trying to do here. So the workshops are extremely organized, very clean. Everybody has a task. And the complexities of this are hard to grasp. Even so, each man or woman has their task, and it's done quickly and efficiently. Because the process leaves room for the shifting and slight unevenness of the weaving process, the patterns become more interesting. You can see also photographs of the Jewish and Tajik wedding rituals. So you can see how the robes and headdresses sort of formed a landscape for these weddings. There's no doubt in my mind that Matisse was influenced by these garments to design the vestments for the Chapelle de Rosaire at Vence in his chapel, because of these textiles.
Well, I think it's for our listeners, there's a lot of photographs that were documented, in the early 20th century and late 19th century, of people working on the ECOT, selling them in the market. And take a look at them. They're on these little computer stands in front of the weavings. They're very helpful to kind of put it in a kind of photographic perspective. You know, we're going to take a break in a little bit, but I wanted you to listen to our next song, which is really interesting, and it's contemporary Central Asian music. And I know for our listeners, this sound would be very, very different, but I think it's very, very beautiful. And the song is by a contemporary Uzbek singer named Moldir Alubelkova. And, you know, before we get into this exotic music, we'd like to announce that there's a benefit concert for Shepherd's Table, and it's tonight, Saturday, April 7th, at the City of Tacoma Park Community Center at 7500 Maple Avenue. And it's with Russ Aulada and friends. This is going to sound like a great gig, and I really like to see our local friends out there. The admission is free, and all donations benefit Shepherd's Table, which is located in downtown Silver Spring. We hope you can support them and listen to great music. And while you're listening to our Central Asian music, why don't you go online and press the donate button at TacomaRadio.org. Your generous donations are tax deductible.
Welcome back. You're listening to WOWD Tacoma Park, 94.3 FM.
Well, there's no catalog for this exhibition, but I wanted to mention, and I think it's really important, that there was a previous exhibition at the Textile Museum years ago in 2010. And the book that for that particular exhibition is really important for this particular one, and it's called Colors of the Oasis, Central Asian Ecots by Sumu Belger Crody and other contributors like Kate Fitzgibbons. And there are other books in the exhibition that are out for the viewers and the public, and this particular book by Sumu Belger Crody is really beautiful, and it really supports this current exhibition. Well, Sheila and I were going through the exhibition, and we were pointing out these most beautiful textiles. I have to say that Sheila and I have the same beautiful taste as our curator, because they came out with this incredible brochure, and make sure you have it when you go through the exhibition. It's absolutely well done. And the cover and inside blurb of this gorgeous little brochure, I would call it, has a magnificent hanging textile in the gallery, which is 4 panels, and it's 6 feet high and almost 4 feet wide, and it's a big panel, and it has these chevron panels of deep red, crimson, red, pink, light blue, yellow, and color harmonies repeated up and down. Between these columns are these patches of these irregular deep blue, kind of blue-black kind of marks, which are sandwiched between these fine red and green lines. These chevron patterns, which is almost like a zigzag, exists in many kinds of Central Asian weaving, especially in Uzbekistan, and it's really kind of powerful on many, many levels. I mean, it's the cover of this brochure, and it's just a knockout design of this brochure, and you really love that kind of visual. And you know, then there's these velvets that are also included in the brochure. What about those velvets?
Oh, man. Yes. Well, there are velvet hangings here, and they're so luscious. You just want to bury your face in them.
Against the rules.
So I never even thought about how is velvet made? Well, here it is. So velvet is woven on a special loom that weaves 2 thicknesses of the material at the same time. And then the 2 pieces are cut apart to create a pile effect. How does that happen? How can you cut it? I keep thinking in my mind, what do you do? And the 2 lengths of fabric are wound on separate take-up rolls. So this is a complicated process. And it meant that velvet was expensive to make before industrial power looms became available. And well-made velvet remains a fairly costly fabric. Velvet is difficult to clean because of its pile, but modern dry cleaning methods make cleaning more feasible. Velvet pile is created by warp, or the vertical yarns, and velveteen pile is created by the weft, which are the fill yarns. Velvet is a closely guarded secret. Pile warp is always silk and densely set and resist dyed. Only the very wealthy can afford velvet. When I was 5, my favorite dress was velvet and taffeta, and I called it that, my velvet and taffeta dress. And the taffeta had a magic quality of appearing red from one angle and green from the other. And now I know it was from the woven silk fibers.
You know, it's so amazing. There's about 5, maybe 6 panels in the exhibition. And those velvets shine. They have an incredible depth. And there's a contemporary nature to them that looks like almost abstract painting. And there's this shine that, you know, I have heard, and I don't really know how true it is, that a lot of the ikats were kind of brushed with egg white, mm-hmm. and it made them shine. It gave them this kind of a moire effect at times. And I don't know if they did the same with the velvet, but the brilliance is amazing. One of the velvets in the exhibition has something that deals with, in color theory, something called analogous color. And it's when you have 3 colors on the color wheel or the spectrum that are next to each other. And one of the velvets, it's so modern, and it's an unusual square format, which most of the hangings are very long and tall. But it's like a violet, a deep blue, and a blue-green, and then there's this kind of crimsony violet. And the same weaving, and it's so subtle and gorgeous. It's kind of modern art. I mean, here it's 200. It's before like the birth of modern art, and yet it's modern.
Yeah, well, some ikat traditions, such as the Central Asia ikats, embrace a blurred aesthetic in that design. Other traditions favor a more precise and more difficult to achieve refinement in the placement of the ikat yarns. And depending on the origin, adjustments in weaving techniques achieve different effects. And just try to figure this out. Chile and Turkestan have similarities in their designs and weaving process. How did that happen?
Well, you know, this is something that in weaving culture, I'm amazed at, that peoples independently came up with the same design and totally opposite ends of the globe. This is something that I think anthropologically is really fascinating. Mm-hmm. And then a good example with this would be the Greek key that we see on, like, you know, pillows. You know, you see them, you see it everywhere, tiles. Mm-hmm. The Greek key is the meander, and it comes from a river in that was part of the Greek sphere, and that's why it's called the meander, and the verb to meander is related to that, obviously. But you see it also in Chinese and Central Asian art. So, you know, there was no connection there, but they came up with the same graphic, and I think that's important.
Yeah.
And you know, Sheila, you know, I know you've got to plug this in, but what about the role of women in this Ikat design?
Here I go. Well, the women did play a very important part, but You have to notice that the men were the designers. They were the ones that set the where the binding was going to go according to the predetermined pattern. And the women were the people that made the garments. They also raised the silkworms. They I'm trying to think of what else they did. They passed the shuttle back and forth in the looms.
Right, yes.
And this is like very laborious work. But the women did contribute also to the aesthetics. And in this, the wealthy people would own, say, 5 coats made of Ikat. And the poorer people had just 1 coat for special occasions.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's one thing that really was weird, is that in these designs, which have a regularity because in fabric there's a repeat, there also are these kind of disruptive strips that are cut and placed in the Ikat itself, and it looks like aesthetic derangement. It looks completely haphazard. The only thing I could think of was a crazy quilt. Like, when you look at it and you see the repetition and you see the regularity, and then suddenly something comes and interferes with the whole thing.
Well, you know, there's something about that to me that I really enjoy looking at those with those irregularities in it, because it puts the human hand into it.
It does.
And, you know, they skipped something, and the tying was different for some reason. And I think that's really exciting. And I know on my cuts they have that as well. You know, but these intricate patterns that are maintained with all these abstracted seed pods, weak scores, scarabs, beetles, scorpions, you know, they pick all this flora and fauna that was around them in nature. And I kind of want to address the graphic movement in the pieces. And that's something we call graphic tessellation. A tessellation is a graphic repeat or a graphic element of a shape or a line or a color or a form. And there could be kind of translations when the graphic element moves from side to side in a slide or a glide. It could be a reflection, a rotation of the graphic element. And these combinations are very evident in these Ikats, and they make them really, really exciting. And, of course, many of our listeners might know M.C. Escher, who really brought the fantastic concept of graphic tessellations to a modern kind of venue. And this exhibition, the Uzbek artisans and designers do it very, very well. And I think that brings to the sophistication of these artists. And why don't we kind of pick apart another one from the show, Sheila?
Sure. Well, I was going to talk about a velvet hanging that is in the brochure. And it's the basic colors are green, red, and yellow. And the yellow is more like an ochre-y, oranger yellow. There are yellows that are very pale, more like the yellows that Vermeer uses.
Right.
And these yellows, maybe from the flower that they come from. And so this particular combination with white is the most beautiful just version of red, yellow, and green, with the white that separates, and that's in the weaving process, and the white separates these colors from each other. And then there's also these sort of flower shapes that are aubergine. And the aubergine is, it's purple, but it's made from indigo and red. And so that's where you get the purple from. And it's a deep color.
You know, yeah, that velvet hanging is just amazing. Mm. And some of the things about the velvet, about the hangings in general in the exhibition is that they kind of remind me of biology on a cellular level. And, you know, here we have, they're from 1840, 1860, and they're like funky CT scans or radiographs. They're really, really wild. I mean, they're cocoon-like, and that's where the modern thinks of. They're wild and modern. And one of the things I wanted to mention, and you talked about these fragmented or reconstructed pieces, that kind of breaks up that the kind of monotony of them in a really, really wonderful way. And again, a lot of these over time have been slit or worn, so they replace them with patches and they're re-sewn. But you know what? It doesn't take away from the power at all of these particular graphics. The sophistication and delicate design of these hangings, we can't understate it enough. And I want to say that some of them are just pure silk, and some of them are silk and cotton. And there's one of a crimson and pink seed pod that looks like that they're floating in a landscape. And that kind of brings up the visual depth to some of these. It's like the seeds are gliding by wind or floating by wind over these. And that one is in the brochure as well. It's so simple, but so mystically creative. I mean, there's a lot of them like that. And I think the visual depth is something that I'd like our listeners to appreciate if you go to see the show. And, you know, these golden yellows, these pale yellows, they're just the gamut of simple color in concentration and in also saturation. And I think they're just, the combinations blow me away. There's like pomegranates and, you know, I mean, everything is just going on and it's vibrant and modern. That's what we're looking at, modern art in some ways.
It's funny that you said that because I was remembering in high school, Paisley was really in. And we used to call them paramecium, those little shapes. And it's what you're saying.
Good for you.
Microscopic level. Yeah, because we were taking biology in high school.
Oh, that's pretty amazing. Well, you know, this exhibition, with its sumptuous use of color, will remind the viewers of our listeners to tie-dye in America, and I think we need to share the relationship here at the end of our show. The tie-dye technique was really something that came to America in odd fashion, but I wanted to mention that tie-dye techniques, they occur on lots of parts of the globe. You had mentioned a bit of North Africa, but Central Africa and West Africa is really big on tie-dye. Ghana has a whole rich tradition of tie-dye, using of indigo and other things. And, of course, we have Southeast Asia, Indonesia, India, and Laos that have tremendous tie-dye techniques as well. And ikat. Remember, they're kind of in the umbrella of the same kind of sphere. And that's what we talked about today. But the tie-dye from Laos and Indonesia are somewhat more somber and neutral in tone. But what I'd like to talk about is also the Far East Asian tie-dye from Japan, which is a rich tie-dye tradition, which comes under the name shibori. Well, within shibori, there are many methods of achieving a tie-dyed fabric. Well, for all you Grateful Dead fans, the rock group and its travels was partly responsible for bringing the methods of shibori back to America after touring in Japan. The rock group knew of Japanese Americans that were doing shibori on the West Coast, but they were re-inspired when they went to Japan, and the band were great promoters of creating the American tie-dye phenomenon, which was propelled with the hippies in the 1960s and the 70s in the drug, sex, and rock and roll era and culture of the West Coast. So there you have it. You know, another type of art cross-pollinization where pollinization where the musicians brought the art back. And of course, we have Yves Saint Laurent in the 1970s, and he brought back Ecot, and it goes on and on. And like Sheila said, you can see it at IKEA.
In their paper napkins. Tom, I wanted to say, in your Ecot shirt today, you look great.
Oh,
I love it.
You.
It's handsome.
You're so complimentary.
It's very handsome.
I wish you could show our listeners.
Yes, I do too. Well, I wanted to say that I have always loved fabric patterns. And especially I love the blousy floral stuff from the 40s. And I have my own collection of those patterns, curtains and slipcovers that I use in my still lifes. So if I could explain this, it's so great because when you paint a pattern, like a floral pattern, the pattern is flat on a fabric, but it also resides in the space of the painting. So you have to distinguish between a three-dimensional flower on a flowered pattern. How do you do that? And then it's on a two-dimensional canvas. So this is a kind of a mind thing to kind of see how that works in painting. And just because the patterns are made of color separations, but that's what you're really doing when you're painting. You're deciding on the colors and the shadows and the lights. So these, as in the Ecots, the endless repeats of the floral patterns are so lively. I once worked in a lingerie fabric company called French Fabrics. And
wow.
For a summer job in New York. And I became really involved in those patterns and how they repeat.
Wow. Well, we'd like to invite everyone to see Binding the Clouds, the Art of Central Asian Ecot, which is at the Textile Museum and George Washington University down in the Foggy Bottom area of D.C. Thank you.
Sing on a ballroom groove.